It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
Well, in my opinion, the reason they're doing it is because they don't want to have to face the music of a judge or a jury who in Virginia can award up to $350,000 in punitive damages. They don't want to have to face a judge or a jury of your peers deciding that what this dealership or this business did was wrong and fraudulent. And they also want to avoid class actions. They also want to make the process more biased, and my feeling is because they'll pick an arbitration group that they send all their business to, who knows that if they start ruling against the business, that arbitration group will no longer be in the contract. So there is also some incentive on the arbitration group to not rule against the business.
Consumer protection attorney and friend of the show, John Gale, discusses consumer arbitration clauses, how to get around them, and what to do if you can't. And during this week's News You Can Use, you'll hear about a landmark Supreme Court of Virginia case that clearly recognizes the doctrine of wrongful foreclosure. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 166, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's News You Can Use. Last month, the Supreme Court of Virginia ruled in favor of a Lovingston-area couple in their fight against the foreclosure of their property. The court decided the lender failed to comply with the terms of the mortgage taken out by Richard and Karen Matthews that required a face-to-face meeting before beginning the foreclosure process. The Matthewses fell behind on their loan payments, and the holder of their note, PHH Mortgage Corporation, appointed another company to begin foreclosure. A foreclosure sale was set for early November 2009. The day before the sale, the couple filed a complaint in Nelson County Circuit Court to stop it, noting that PHH representatives were required to meet with them at least 30 days before beginning foreclosure, but did not. The mortgage company responded, under Virginia common law, the person who first breaks a contract cannot sue to enforce it. It also said it was excluded from the meeting requirement because HUD had determined it was only required if the lender had a servicing office within 200 miles of the mortgaged property. The company had no such office. The circuit court agreed and dismissed the Matthews complaint in February 2011. In October 2011, the Supreme Court of Virginia agreed to hear an appeal. Last month's decision held that under a similar 2008 case, lenders must comply with all terms in a contract leading up to foreclosure, and non-payment of a mortgage is not the sort of breach preventing a borrower from seeking to enforce those terms. The HUD meeting requirements were incorporated into the loan because it was backed by the Federal Housing Administration. Under the regulation, the meetings are not required if the mortgage property is not within 200 miles of a lender's branch office. HUD limited the definition of branch office to be a servicing office with staff trained to discuss options with the borrower behind on his payments. However, The court disagreed because the regulation itself does not support this limitation. To accept HUD's interpretation would amount to creating a new regulation or amending the regulation without following the proper statutory procedure. The Supreme Court also noted that borrowers should be able to travel to a lender's branch office and meet with properly trained employees via tele or video conference. The case, Matthews v. PHH Mortgage Corporation, was handled by the former executive director of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society, Henry McLaughlin. With this week's news you can use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
This week's case that changed the Commonwealth is Cook versus Heckler. In 1983, S.E. Cook, then 51 years old, applied for Social Security disability benefits based upon arthritis in her hips, knees, shoulders, wrists, and fingers, as well as major depression, severe anxiety, and borderline intelligence. Benefits were denied by the Social Security Administration and the United States District Court because neither the arthritis nor the mental impairments were considered disabling. But the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals reversed and sent the case back for additional proceedings. The appeals court ruled that Social Security improperly focused on each impairment separately and failed to consider their combined effect. The court observed that Social Security must evaluate the combined severity of multiple impairments without regard to whether any such impairment, if considered separately, would be of sufficient severity, and make a specific and well-articulated finding as to the effect of the combination of impairments. This has been the law ever since. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussault, and Cook versus Heckler is this week's case that changed the Commonwealth.
Welcome back to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio. We're here with attorney John Cole Gale, Jr. He is the president of the Consumer Law Group in the near west end of Henrico County, and we are going to be talking today about consumer arbitration. Welcome back to the show, John.
Glad to be back, Marty. Thanks for coming.
John, will you tell our listening audience, what is consumer arbitration?
Arbitration is a substitute process for litigating a dispute in court. In other words, instead of a dispute going to a court of law where a judge or a jury determines whether you win or lose or how much your damages are, an arbitration agreement is something that is written in a contract that you, the consumer, and the business has signed, which says that in the event of a dispute, that the dispute will not go to litigation, but will go to an arbitration forum where the business oftentimes, 99% of the time, dictates the company or companies that will arbitrate the dispute. And they will sometimes say that the costs of the arbitration are borne by the business, or those agreements will say the cost of the arbitration will be split, or they say the cost of the arbitration agreement will be something decided by the arbitrator. And this is agreement that prevents you, except in small dollar cases, sometimes the limit is about $10,000 in the amount of the dispute. But if it's over a car or a larger item, these cases will more than often than not go into arbitration rather than to a court of law.
And it sounds as if these arbitration clauses are placed into the contracts by the businesses, by the companies that give you a standard form contract. Why are they doing this?
Well, in my opinion, the reason they're doing it is because they don't want to have to face the music of a judge or a jury who in Virginia can award up to $350,000 in punitive damages. They don't want to have to face a judge or a jury of your peers deciding that what this dealership or this business did was wrong and fraudulent. And they also want to avoid class actions. They also want to make the process more biased. My feeling is because they'll pick an arbitration group that they send all their business to, who knows that if they start ruling against the business, that arbitration group will no longer be in the contract. So there is also some incentive on the arbitration group to not rule against the business. They find it a way to avoid the hassle and the expense of litigation because they would have to hire an attorney.
Now, you mentioned that these arbitration clauses can sometimes exempt small claims. Can you tell us what that loophole would be and whether there's any other way to avoid an arbitration clause that's in a contract?
The small claims exemption is something that's often written in the arbitration clause itself. It's not something that by law says it. It's just that most of the arbitration agreements I've seen will state that if the claim is for a certain amount of dollars or less, then it can go into litigation. Just because it's not worth it for the business to sometimes have to pay for the arbitration when they're going to have to pay arbitration fees of $2,000 or $3,000 for a claim that's only $3,000 or $4,000. So in those cases, they don't want to have to be forced into that payment by the consumer choosing the arbitration. So they make the lower end limit of the arbitration, sometimes around $10,000. Some will talk about general district court if the arbitration claim is of an amount that could go into general district court. That dollar limit of general district court, which in Virginia is $25,000, that can go in there. But most of the time, my recollection is that the agreements specify a $10,000 limit to those that can go into litigation.
And so what happens if a consumer faced with an arbitration clause like that decides, well, the limit in Virginia is $25,000, I'm going to go ahead and sue the company anyway. What happens then?
The company has the choice, if their lawyers even know about the arbitration agreement, to compel the consumer into an arbitration forum by filing a motion in court to stay, S-T-A-Y, stay the case so that the case does not go forward in litigation and the judge will order the consumer and the business into arbitration pursuant to the arbitration agreement. What that means is that you the consumer or the business then calls up the arbitration group that's designated and you say, I have arbitration and it's against XYZ company, and they say, fill out this form. And based on the arbitration agreement, if there are some fees the consumer has to pay, then the consumer pays them. The business will then have to pay their fees. You choose an arbitrator from a group of names they give you, and then you set up a trial date, a hearing date, and you go forward as if you were in front of a trial, but it's actually in front of an arbitrator who hopefully is fair, but sometimes you just don't know.
Well, let's talk about the fees. You said there's a number of different ways that the arbitration agreement can structure the fees. It could be that the company has to pay them all up front, or that it's split between the parties, or it's decided later on by the arbitrator. Let's assume it's one of those agreements where the consumer has to pay at least some part of the fees in order to even get the arbitration. And let's say the consumer is indigent or just does not have the money to pay those arbitration fees. What happens then?
Most of the arbitration groups that are designated in the panels, I'm talking about AAA, that is American Arbitration Association. There's another group called JAMS. Most of these national arbitration groups will have a provision that if the person who is attempting to arbitrate the matter cannot afford the cost, that there is a process for them to make application based on their income to avoid those costs. I will say that most of the arbitration agreements I'm seeing, I do a lot of automobile litigation, and most of the arbitration agreements I'm seeing from automobile dealerships have the amount that the consumer has to pay is often about the same amount as they would have to pay were they filing their case in court. So it's not as if that arbitration cost up front is going to make it more difficult for the consumer to have redress to their complaint. Problem is that the rules of all these groups give the arbitrator the right to award all the costs of the litigation to the winner if they want to. So the consumer who doesn't have very much money faces the possibility that if they lose, the arbitrator would award all the cost of the arbitration, which includes the cost of the arbitrator, against the consumer, and he or she or they are facing, in a case like that, $2,000 or $3,000 or $4,000 bill at the end of the case if they lose.
And isn't that quite different than the normal civil litigation in court, where in general we have what we call the American rule? Each party pays their own way, their own attorney's fees, unless there's some statute or maybe something in a contract that says otherwise. Doesn't this shift that around completely? Yeah,
absolutely, and this is one of the travesties of arbitration, in that there are a lot of people out there who have a decent or a good grievance or a problem where they've been screwed and they want some sort of a redress. The business is stonewalling them, but they don't want to have to face the prospect of potentially losing the case and having to pay all those fees at the end.
Well, now let's assume that the consumer decides to go ahead, notwithstanding that risk. Again, you go back to the arbitration clause in the contract, and you say sometimes it names an arbitrator, or sometimes it will name several different possible arbitrators. Who ultimately makes that decision? Is this something between the consumer and the business, or does the business just choose amongst its list? How is the actual identity of the arbitration group or the arbitrator determined?
Well, you've got two choices that have to be made. First, the person filing the arbitration will usually be the one who chooses which arbitration group to choose that you have been given a choice of in the arbitration clause itself. Then, once you've chosen a group, you then go to the group and say, we'd like you to arbitrate our case, and who are the arbitrators you will have us choose between? And depending on which group it is, some groups will simply dictate which arbitrator, a particular arbitrator. Others will give you a panel, meaning a panel of two or three or four names for you to choose from, you and your opponent to choose from, and you have to agree on someone on that panel to be your arbitrator. If you cannot agree on anyone on that panel because you think one of they're biased, or the other side thinks the people you chose are biased, then the arbitration group's rules usually dictate that they will then designate a particular person. Now, one other thing you asked, Marty, was, I think is important, is there a way to get out of arbitration? And the answer is usually no. I have fought many battles in court trying to get the court to order the arbitration null and void and let us go forward based on the fact that the contract was induced by fraud. In other words, if the business was allegedly lying to me to get me to sign the contract, I shouldn't be forced into anything in the contract. Unfortunately, let's go to the end of this. Almost all the courts that I'm aware of in Virginia now will enforce an arbitration clause unless the clause itself was signed on the basis of fraud. In other words, if someone, for example, speaks Spanish and is unable to read and says, what is this clause you're trying to get me to sign? And the person presenting the contract says, well, that's simply a clause, we're providing you a warranty, and lies to them, and they are unable to understand it, then that would be a fraud with regard to the arbitration clause itself. And I think in that instance, the laws in the country would prohibit the arbitration from going forward.
Well, now, who are the actual arbitrators? Do they have to be lawyers, or can they just be knowledgeable laypeople?
An arbitrator can be anyone that the arbitration group has designated to be an arbitrator. Most arbitration groups will require an arbitrator to go through some sort of training, but it can be a layperson, it can be a lawyer, it can be a retired judge. My preference, of course, would be to have a retired judge over a layperson or a lawyer, but it can be any one of those three.
And, of course, when you take a case to court, there are court rules. There are rules of procedure. Soon in Virginia, we'll have rules of evidence. Are there arbitration rules? And if so, how do you find out what they are and how do you enforce them?
Well, the arbitration rules vary depending on the group. So whenever you're deciding on which arbitration group that you want to use that's in your clause, arbitration clause, you might want to review their rules. Some of the rules will say the rules of evidence in a court are not necessarily applicable. One of the advantages of arbitration for people that I represent, which are normally the little guy, is that we can't always get all of our witnesses there. And since the rules of evidence are not always applicable, we are allowed to get, we lawyers call hearsay, into evidence, where my client can say, well, so-and-so told me that this person did this, and the arbitrator can at least hear it. Whereas in a court of law, that would not be permitted.
So that at least gives one slight advantage to arbitration that you would not have in a court of law. And I guess my final question would be, do you find in your experience that arbitration is roughly as fair a process as court, a lot less fair? How would you compare and contrast the two?
I am not as much of an opponent of arbitration as some others. I have done everything I can when I'm forced into arbitration by a clause, to do everything I can to find a fair arbitrator. By that I mean, you can choose the arbitration group that's listed, but what I will often do is go to the business and appeal to them and to their lawyer and say, look, we can use AAA, or we can use JAMS, or we can use some other one of these forums that are listed. But oftentimes, these are arbitrators from Washington, D.C. They're from people away from town, and they are very expensive. And if the business loses, they're going to have to pay a lot of money. And so my appeal is that I will say to this lawyer for the business, let's use another group. Let's use a local retired judge who is fair, and we will discuss a fair judge that's local, whether this is Northern Virginia or Richmond or Roanoke or the beach or wherever. And more often than not, I found opposing counsel agreeable to finding someone that's neutral, because it's going to save their client some money. And as a result, my arbitration results have been pretty good. I do want to add one other thing that I think is very important for everyone in this audience. When you are signing a contract, you need to look on the front or back to see if there's an arbitration clause. And if there is an arbitration clause, you have the absolute right to cross it out and say, I don't agree with that. And hopefully the business will go through with the transaction. Many times they'll say, well, that's a requirement. You can't buy this product without this arbitration agreement. And then you should just walk out the door. There are car dealerships, there are businesses that don't have arbitration clauses. And if the public would stop buying products from businesses that have arbitration clauses and go to their competitor that doesn't have an arbitration clause, the free market system would work and they would quickly stop those arbitration clauses. So that's my appeal. When you see an arbitration clause, walk up and go away unless they agree to take it out.
Well, thank you very much. We have been speaking with John Cole Gale, Jr. He is the president of the Consumer Law Group in the near west end of Henrico County. We have been talking about arbitration clauses, how to spot them, what to do about them, and why you should not agree with them. Thank you so much for being on the show, John.
Thank you. I was glad to be some help.
Welcome back to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
This week's Strange But True Law is from Title 56, which deals with public service companies. Under Code of Virginia Section 56-234.1, it is the duty of every public utility upon written request by the customer to determine the lowest rate applicable, provided that the utility is required to make a determination for any single customer more frequently than annually. If the rate charged thereafter is not the lowest rate applicable, the public utility is liable to the customer for the difference between the amount paid by the customer and the amount that would have been paid if the customer had been charged the lowest rate applicable after the customer's request. In other words, you get the lowest rate for a utility, but only if you ask for it. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Michelle King, and that's this week's Strange But True Law.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio show ever broadcast is available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral 4, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. Next month, the American Civil Liberties Union of Virginia gets its first new executive director in more than 20 years. Join us next week when Claire Gastanaga, former Chief Deputy Attorney General and incoming ACLU of Virginia Executive Director, talks about the civil liberties challenges facing Virginians. That's law for the rest of us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegmeyer.